Hello, and welcome to the Jazzin Podcast, the monthly podcast where we highlight an exciting paper from the current issue of the journal. The papers may be clinical, basic, or translational, and they're chosen to reflect the diversity of Jazzin content. I'm Dr. David Ellison, Professor of Medicine and Chemical Physiology and Biochemistry at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm a deputy editor at the journal. Today, I'm joined by Doctors John Demko and David Pierce to discuss their interesting paper entitled Coordinated Regulation of Renal Glucose Reabsorption and Gluconeogenesis by mTORC2 and Potassium, which appears in the current issue of JASN and is currently online. So if you please introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about your background and how you got to be involved in writing this paper.
I'm John Demko. I'm a nephrologist that's currently transitioning from basic science research at UCSF in David's lab for about the past 5 years, now to a more clinical role at UPenn focused on hypertension.
Hi, David. Nice to be here with you. As you know, I'm a professor of medicine and cellular and molecular pharmacology at UCSF, and I've been interested in aldosterone actions in the distal nephron for many years. This project was a surprising outgrowth of that line of research.
Great, and can't wait to hear more about this because this is an area that I'm very interested in, and I think many people around the world are interested in. So first, I'd like to know sort of more about how this study came about. As you mentioned, and I know that David's been interested for many years in aldosterone, and more recently interested in mTORC2, and you've worked with mTORC2 disruption models, mouse models, in the past. But it sounds like you may have stumbled on this observation of glycosuria in these mice almost by accident. So I'm wondering what led you to the current studies, and was this a hypothesis-driven study, or did it sort of appear surprisingly?
Well, no, not initially. It was not hypothesis driven. It was really quite by accident. As you mentioned, my lab has been interested in the role of mTORC2 in activating SGK1, which is a central activator of ENaC in the distal nephron. We've been working on that for well over a decade. Bhadisha Saha, who's a highly talented scientist in the lab, began characterizing potassium handling of mTORC2 knockout mice that John's going to say a little bit more about. And she noticed the glycosuria. But until John came to the lab, we hadn't made much of the findings since mTORC2, well known to be involved in gluconeogenesis, and Michael Hall had shown that liver knockouts have hyperglycemia. So, although it could be an interesting topic to pursue, it seemed like it might just be tilling well-tilled basic research. And so we kind of left it aside. And we didn't think that the hyperglycemia would be related to actions of SGLT1 and 2. Well, this turned out not to be the case. Say, John, do you want to tell them a little bit more about that?
Sure. When I joined the lab, as David mentioned, Bhadisha Saha had really consistently shown that these mTORC2 knockout animals had glycosuria, and it was very consistent in all of our experiments. And what's more interesting is that the glycosuria in the knockout mice was very significant on a normal potassium diet, but then it seemed to disappear on a high potassium diet. Looking back at older literature from the lab, the same thing happened in older papers when treating with an mTOR inhibitor, AZD8055, and all of this data was very consistent. So it seemed like something was going on here. Since SGLT2 inhibition or SGLT2 inhibitors were a really hot topic and still are in nephrology, it seemed like a good idea to take a closer look at this and really design experiments specifically addressed to assess glucose handling in these mice.
Great. And maybe get you to describe a little bit more about what you found in a minute. But I, you know, in reading the paper and wearing my clinical hat, you know, I don't usually think a lot about the gluconeogenic activity of kidney. Now, I do know that patients with end-stage kidney disease are at some risk for hypoglycemia, and especially obviously if combined with liver disease, and that's when we sometimes will see hypoglycemia. But I think that, as you point out, the recent interest in the so-called CKM, or cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome, and the development of the SGLT2 inhibitors, as well as the GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs, are really highlighting how closely linked the actions of the kidney and metabolism are, and how important is to understand those actions. But one thing that surprised me, and maybe you can tell me if it should be surprising or if it shouldn't be surprising, is the effect of insulin. We know that insulin reduces plasma glucose, and yet stimulating glucose absorption in the kidney, as you mentioned that insulin does, seems like it would raise glucose rather than reducing it. So it seemed like a paradoxical effect, perhaps. But you've talked about the fact this has been documented for many years, these two different effects of insulin on systemic glucose and glucose reabsorption. I wonder if you can discuss how you think about that.
Yeah, sure. I'll launch into it, and then maybe John will have some more comments about that. I think if you look at insulin as being a regulator of energy homeostasis as opposed to strictly glucose handling, it starts to make more sense. And John really came up with this kind of way of describing it. I'll just say that the liver is an important a regulator of glucose per se, of course, but part of that is related to its effects in storing glycogen, which the kidneys don't do. The kidneys can contribute enormously to gluconeogenesis, particularly during prolonged fasting. That's a relatively recent insight, going back about 15 years. And the other important point is that patients with insulin resistance fail to suppress renal gluconeogenesis, leading to hyperglycemia based on studies where the renal vein was cannulated. John, maybe you want to say a little bit more about the glucose transport aspects of this.
I'll comment on the transport and then how I sort of put all of this together with transport and gluconeogenesis. It's very interesting, given how popular SGLT2 inhibitors are now, that we really don't understand the regulation of SGLT1 and SGLT2 and glucose reabsorption all that well. It's, as has been mentioned, known for a long time, patients with type 2 diabetes in particular have increased renal glucose reabsorptive capacity, and it's probably related to insulin signaling. Studies that have looked at what the mechanism is on a molecular level, there's a little bit of conflicting evidence. Is it SGLT1? Is it SGLT2? Is it both? Is it a basolateral glucose transporter? But maybe the reason for some of this conflicting evidence is because they're all looking at slightly different models of insulin resistance, but it is a very clear phenomenon. It took us some time to really reconcile what we were seeing with regard to glucose transport and the gluconeogenesis data, specifically how mTORC2 is responsible for stimulating glucose reabsorption and suppressing gluconeogenesis. It helps me to think of this from an evolutionary perspective. So I imagine when an animal eats a meal and blood sugar levels rise and insulin levels increase, to me, it makes sense that the kidneys should reduce glucose production in this energy-rich state, since there's plenty of glucose around, and simultaneously, the kidney should increase its glucose reabsorptive capacity while the blood sugar is elevated to prevent energy loss in the urine in this energy-rich state.
Great. I think that's sort of, as I reread the paper this morning, I sort of was able to see that line of thought, and so I appreciate your sharing that. So, my group has been interested for a number of years in potassium intake and potassium balance, and part of your paper is about just some fundamental signaling mechanisms in the kidney, which is interesting, but especially as you think about a future role, John, as a clinician. The fact that this can be manipulated by potassium diet is, I think, super interesting because, as you both know well, there's a lot of discussion around the world in the importance of supplementing potassium in the diet. So maybe you could just summarize a little bit about how what the fundamental findings were, and then how that was or is affected by increasing potassium in the diet, and then how you see that playing out in a more translational way.
Absolutely.
John, why don't you go ahead and tackle that one?
So to summarize, the main things we found in our mice that had mTORC2 knocked out throughout the renal tubule, we found that in the mTORC2 knockout mice, glucose reabsorption was decreased. They had glycosuria because there was less SGLT2 and less SGLT1 at the plasma membrane. And at the same time, these mice had elevated gluconeogenesis. And we found that when we put these animals from a normal potassium 0.5% K diet onto a high 3% K diet, this phenotype essentially went away. The glycosuria was dramatically reduced. We saw no difference in SGLT1 and SGLT2 at the plasma membrane between our knockouts and our wild type. And the markers of gluconeogenesis we looked at also normalized in our knockouts compared to our wild type just by putting them on a high potassium diet. So, as you mentioned, I think that high K diets having an important protective role or beneficial role in human health is really important and really interesting. There's very good data about how high K diets, like the DASH diet, lead to better cardiovascular outcomes, reduced mortality. A lot of this, I think, is probably mediated by high potassium reducing blood pressure. But it's really fascinating to speculate that high dietary potassium might actually help with glucose regulation and glucose handling. Specifically, maybe high dietary potassium is suppressing gluconeogenesis independent of insulin and mTORC2, which you could imagine might help a human with insulin resistance and high blood sugar. High potassium could suppress gluconeogenesis and restore normal glucose levels.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. I was aware because I've been interested in diuretics and potassium for a long time that there's a lot of speculation in older literature about the hyperglycemic effects of thiazide diuretics. And for a while it was very popular to speculate, and it may be true that part of that hyperglycemic effect of thiazides is relating to the hypokalemia that they can induce. And so this would fit very well together. I guess, as I thought about your study, and I think that we learn more and more about this cardiometabolic kidney axis, you mentioned before the evolutionary advantages of these kind of effects, that insulin increases, glucose uptake by cells and is helpful for energy homeostasis. But for organisms to grow, you also need potassium. And if you're deficient in potassium, that may be a different part of the same kind of signaling mechanism. So it's very interesting to think about that in a translational way. And I'll probably ask you a last question, John, about that when we get to the end. But I want to move on to talk about your last set of experiments. You used a different Cre driver to disrupt mTORC2 signaling only along mostly the S3 segment, although it may have some effects in earlier segments. And that's where SGLT1 should be most important. So I just want you to tell the listeners a little bit more about why you decided to do the sort of proximal tubule specific knockout and what the specific fact that this is mostly S3 tells us about the phenomenon you're studying here.
Yeah, I'll let John talk about that, but I just want to emphasize, the serendipity plays a role. This was a model that was available to us, and so we jumped on it. I think the findings, and John can tell you a little bit more about that, but the findings are very interesting. But we really do need to do a knockout, characterize a knockout in the S1, S2, which is really where the SGLT2 is. But John, why don't you tell them a little bit more about the model and the findings?
Yeah, the main reason we really wanted to isolate something in the proximal tubule is because we know that our Turco mouse with the whole nephron mTORC2 knockout also have impaired distal potassium secretion such that they will develop hyperkalemia on a high K diet. So we were aware that the hyperkalemia relative to wild type animals might confound some of our results. Maybe that was impacting this phenomenon where high potassium reduced the glycosuria. So we really wanted to see if we could isolate a proximal tubule-only knockout if we saw the same phenotype, which glycosuria on a normal K diet that went away on a high K diet. And indeed, we saw that when we took our S3 segment knockout alone, there was glycosuria on normal K, it went away on high K, and these animals did not develop hyperkalemia relative to wild type, and they shouldn't have any impaired distal nephron K excretion since this knockout was specific to S3.
Great. I think the cartoon at the end of your paper shows very nicely how the results fit together, and I'd actually recommend any listeners who want to sort of get a summary of the paper to look at their cartoon. It shows how insulin is acting in part through mTORC2 to affect both gluconeogenesis and SGLT2 activities. But given that filtered glucose is typically completely reabsorbed pretty much all the time along the proximal tubule, at least in normal individuals who don't have diabetes mellitus, I wondered, what do you think that the activation of SGLTs 1 and 2 is accomplishing? Is it just there as a protector if the organism develops hyperglycemia? I mean, why would we need this under normal conditions when we typically reabsorb essentially all of our glucose?
That's a great question. I think that normally, in normal physiology, you have SGLT2 as a high capacity, low affinity transporter that's reabsorbing the bulk of the filtered glucose. And SGLT1 is sort of a low capacity, high affinity transporter that's mopping up about the last 10% of glucose that gets by in non-diabetic individuals. So I think that maybe after a meal when insulin and blood sugar levels are high, again, thinking about this perhaps evolutionarily evolved mechanism, the reabsorptive capacity of both segments goes up to preserve this relationship and reabsorb all glucose. It'd be really interesting to see if we could isolate SGLT2 and S1, S2, or SGLT1 and S3 to see what happens to glucose reabsorption in both a healthy state and in a model with insulin resistance to see if this relationship is preserved.
Yeah, and I'll just add that it is notable that diabetics have increased SGLT1 and 2 and greater glucose reabsorptive capacity than non-diabetic individuals. And that suggests that there is indeed a regulation in that space. I think at this point, we don't have a complete understanding of the mechanism or of the clinical implications of the findings. It's really fertile ground for further research.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I just got to mention, just spontaneously reminded me that we did a previous podcast about a JASN paper a while ago in which the investigators used a single cell RNA-seq to look at what changes happened when SGLT2 was inhibited. And showed that there was sort of a change in the S3 segment that became more S1 and 2 like. And I think there'll be very interesting follow-on. You may be planning this already, but to look at how inhibiting mTORC2 in the proximal tubule affects signaling mechanisms downstream and also in the cells themselves, because that's another one of the other areas of interest with the SGLT2 inhibitors is how they protect the kidney. And one hypothesis has been by altering energy metabolism in the proximal tubule itself. So, that, John, I wanted to just finish this up. You mentioned at the beginning that you've transitioned to a more clinical role at the University of Pennsylvania, but and focused in part on hypertension. So you can probably see a lot of people who may be on potassium deficient diets, who may be treated with SGLT2 inhibitors as well as other drugs. Right now, more and more groups, both cardiovascular groups and renal groups, are recommending multiple different drugs to use at the same time. So can you just for a minute tell me how do you think this might fit into what you do as a practitioner going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. Things that I think about, we have so many patients on SGLT2 inhibitors now. The indications are just constantly expanding in the chronic kidney disease world and the heart failure world and diabetes. And some interesting things that stand out to me, one of the questions is, if you inhibit SGLT1 in addition to SGLT2, do you get more renal protective and health protective benefits? And sotagliflozin is one SGLT2 and a little bit of an SGLT1 inhibitor that I think there's more trials underway to see if perhaps there's greater benefit when you combine inhibition. And when thinking about the role of potassium, I actually think there's already very good evidence that we should be telling patients that don't have problems with hyperkalemia to be on a high potassium diet, both to help reduce blood pressure and to help reduce cardiovascular events. There's a huge body of literature showing that this is definitely a good idea. I think it'd be really interesting to know if my patients that also have insulin resistance would get further benefit from being on a high potassium diet, perhaps because the high K is not just reducing blood pressure, but also helping with glucose homeostasis.
And I'll just add an editorial comment myself that one of the other drugs or one of the other classes of drugs is used increasingly in patients with all these kind of diseases is mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, whether they're nonsteroidal or steroidal. And all of those drugs do tend to raise potassium. So going back to where David started in all this, a lot of the benefits of a high potassium diet are probably mediated by the increase in plasma potassium, albeit a modest one. And so we may be also helping patients by giving those other classes of drugs together. Obviously, the risks of hyperkalemia still scare people, and that'll be one of the things you need to think about as a practitioner going forward. Well, I think this is a fascinating study that has clear translational implications. It shows also, as David mentioned, how serendipity can lead to some of the best observations. And that's something we should all keep in mind and keep our minds prepared to note things that happen spontaneously and then follow up on them. So really thank you both for participating in this discussion, and I look forward to hearing more about the this area of research. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.